Good evening, gentle homos. Welcome to this evening's July 2009 edition of Science News Update. I'm your host, Jim Campanella, and I wish I could tell you from what piece of ancient SF in my youth I picked up that strangely disturbing greeting. This is a very special edition of the update because tonight we celebrate its one-year anniversary. I have enjoyed digging up interesting bits of information for you over the last year and presenting those tasty scientific tidbits. I thank Tony and all of my loyal listeners. I hope that you found this monthly silliness as enlightening as I have. I want you to all know that I think this podcast helps make me a better teacher and scientist, and I'm grateful for the opportunity. Before this descends into teary-eyed blather, let's get started here. I will now present a short audio clip to you that is related to the first story of the night. The clip is from the fourth season premiere episode of the very funny SF TV show Red Dwarf. Fans will immediately recognize the situation, but let me explain to those of you who are not familiar with what you hear. Dave Lister is a crewman aboard the mining ship Red Dwarf. He's chatting with an android by the name of Crichton. Lister is deeply concerned that Crichton cannot lie as a machine, and he's trying to encourage the mechanoid to break its programming by teaching it how to lie. Here, Lister is trying to explain the social importance of being able to lie.
Oh, it's no good, sir. I just can't lie. I'm programmed always to tell the truth.
Crichton, it's easy. Look, an orange, a melon, a female aardvark.
Oh, that is just so superb, sir. How do you do that? Especially calling a banana an aardvark. An aardvark isn't even a fruit. It's total genius.
Let's start again. Oh,
sir, my head is spinning. We've been doing this all morning.
Crichton, I'm going to teach you how to lie and cheat if it's the last thing I do. I'm going to teach you to be unpleasant, cruel, and sarcastic. It's the only way to break your programming, man. Make you independent.
And I'm truly grateful, sir. Don't you think I'd love to be deceitful, unpleasant, and offensive? Those are the human qualities I admire the most. But I just can't do it.
You can.
I can't.
Look, what's this?
No.
What is it?
Please.
Come on, what is it?
It's a small off-duty Czechoslovakian traffic warden.
Yes, you did it, you did it. What's this?
It's a red and blue striped golfing umbrella.
Yes, what's this?
It's an apple.
No,
what is it? It's the Bolivian Navy on maneuvers in the South Pacific.
Well, Crichton, man, you can do it.
No, I can't.
Yes, you... Oh, nice one.
Well, I can't hang around here. I better go away and take the penguin for a walk. I can do it. I did it again. I can lie.
Come here. Check this.
What?
Concentrate, Crichton. What's this?
It's a banana.
What's this?
It's an orange.
What's this?
You taught him that? That's terrific. You two should audition for What's My Fruit.
I did it wrong, man.
Oh, it gets better.
I just can't do it.
You can, you just did it.
I just can't do it, not when there's someone else there. What's a suitable human analogy? It's like trying to urinate in a public lavatory when you're standing next to a man 2 foot taller than you. It's just not possible.
What are you trying to do exactly?
He's trying to teach me how to lie, sir.
Any particular reason?
Yeah. Lying's a vital part of your psychological defense system. You're naked without it. If you can't lie, then you can't conceal your true intentions from other people. Sometimes that's essential. I mean, like, take Nelson. When he put the telescope up to his blind eye and said, I see no ships. Or like Humphrey Bogart at the end of Casablanca, where he lies to Victor Laszlo to protect the guy's feelings.
And I understand the theory, sir. How many times have you made me watch that movie? I understand that it can be noble to lie. I just can't do it.
You can't. Look, what's this?
It's a banana. It always has been a banana. It always will be a banana. It's a yellow fruit that you unzip and eat the white bits. It's a banana.
So what does that clip have to do with anything? Well, for a long time, anthropologists and biologists have believed that only humans can purposely mislead. Certainly we know that plants and animals can mimic other plants and animals, or even landscape, in order to protect themselves or help procreate. But there have been no real instances of animals actively misleading others as humans might do. That is, real out-and-out lying. Well, it turns out that capuchin monkeys apparently have the ability to prevaricate as well. Dr. Brandon Wheeler and his associates of Stony Brook University published a paper at the end of June in the Proceedings of the Royal Society. The paper examined the social interactions of younger and older capuchins in a troop of monkeys. They found that capuchin monkeys can actually cry out the predator warning in Monkey to trick more senior members of their troop into fleeing the dinner table. Of course, that leaves the food for the younger monkeys. Wheeler performed the work in Argentina. He started noticing at one point that a well-studied population of approximately 25 Capuchin monkeys were giving hiccup calls when they shouldn't be. Hiccup calls are two-syllable cooing sounds commonly uttered in response to danger. Here's what it sounds like. Wheeler said, quote, "There was no apparent reason to give these calls other than to chase the other individuals off the food platform," unquote. To test out exactly what was going on with the calls, Wheeler placed highly valued banana pieces on a small feeding platform 3 to 10 meters above the ground. He was not only able to elicit these calls at 10 times the rate they occur in natural contexts, he was able to correlate this behavior with individual rank, food distribution, and proximity to food resources. With only one exception, the calls were produced exclusively by subordinate individuals. It makes sense because there would be no reason for dominant monkeys to call out like that because they could take whatever food they wanted anyway. There is still some question as to whether the monkeys are purposely misleading or not, though. The researchers say that, quote, "it does look like tactical deception," unquote. But they have no way of knowing whether the monkeys are actually intending to deceive or not. There's a difference between intentional deception and what researchers refer to as functional deception. Functional deception falls into the category of the animals and plants that deceive by altering their body or color for protection. A plant that disguises itself as a rock to not be predated upon is performing functional deception. Intentional deception, on the other hand, is just what it sounds like. If the individual that's acting deceptively understands that they're creating false belief, then it is intentional. If the monkeys are intentionally being deceptive, then they understand that they are making the other group members believe there is a predator present. Researchers are already considering the evolution of alarm calls. It's possible that alarm calls among animals arose just as much from deception as from actual alarm. It may be the deception arose from calls that had a much broader range of meanings originally. The researchers suggest that deceptions could be a quote-unquote spandrel that's a byproduct of the function of the original signal. Our next story is a bit of an update on one of our older ones. I have discussed DNA sequencing of the human genome before. I've mentioned that if you can afford to have it done, it's about $100,000. There's a company in Cambridge, Massachusetts called Canome, which will do it for you. You may remember that I predicted almost a year ago that the price would start to drop soon for whole genome sequencing. Well, that's beginning to happen now. Illumina, a genomics technology company headquartered in San Diego, California, announced the launch of a $48,000 genome sequencing service at the Consumer Genetics Conference in Boston at the end of June. This is a major breakthrough in price, and it will continue to fall. Illumina can do this because they themselves are major suppliers of equipment and reagents needed to actually perform the sequencing, so that they can do it more cheaply than someone who they are selling those apparatus and reagents to. Now, the other cool thing is that unlike most consumer genomics companies, which offer tests directly through the internet, Illumina's genome sequencing service will require a physician's prescription. This tells me that they are actually serious and not a fly-by-night operation taking advantage of people as a fad. Even better, the company will implement a 7-day waiting period after an individual surrenders his saliva for analysis to give customers time to make sure that they truly want to know the contents of their genome. So for less than half the cost of Canome, you can know all the secrets squirreled away in your DNA. Or will you? What exactly are you getting for $48,000? Well, Illumina is performing a 30-fold coverage of the entire genome. An individual's DNA has to be analyzed multiple times to generate a comprehensive sequence. That literally means that they will have to sequence your entire multi-billion base pair DNA 30 times in order to ensure that they have the correct sequence. So that sounds like a lot. It sounds like it's worth $48,000. But do you get anything else? Well, no, not really. Illumina is reading the code for you and making sure that it's right, but they are doing minimal analysis of your code for all that money. Instead, they're going to leave the genetic analysis to other companies. Illumina has announced partnerships with the other four major consumer genomics companies, Canome, 23andMe, Navigenics, and Decode. Jay Flatley, Illumina's CEO, said at the Consumer Genetics Conference that, quote, each company will develop its own analysis packages at an additional cost, and consumers will be able to pick the one that they want, unquote. You already know my opinion of 23andMe as a company from past podcasts. The idea of making your genome into an online Twitter-like discussion locus just seems more than a bit lowbrow to me in a very odd sort of way. And it just seems weird that Illumina would go to all the trouble of making you get a doctor's prescription to get your DNA sequenced, and then they would get clowns like that to help you analyze the sequences. I just hope that the other companies involved are a bit more respectful. But perhaps even Illumina is not quite as respectful of the human genome as they appear at first blush. The company is already developing an application for the iPhone that would allow consumers to interact with their genetic information in different ways. One example is a feature that determines whether their particular genome would interact well with particular drugs, such as those to lower blood pressure. Interesting, but also kind of gimmicky at the same time. You would think that you'd want your doctor to do that and not have to do it personally. It's turning out now that we are so good at sequencing DNA that the analysis of the genome, rather than the sequencing itself, is proving to be the most difficult aspect of personalized genomic medicine. While scientists have identified hundreds of genetic variations linked to the risk of specific diseases, the meaning of the vast majority of the genome is still pretty much unknown. And in most cases, scientists don't know yet how to combine genetic risk factors with the environmental risk factors to produce accurate predictions for any likelihood of developing a specific disease. So that even with your tricked-out iPhone, it may be years before you can completely trust those genomic analyses. By the way, how can I be so certain that the price is going to drop farther? Well, at that same genomic conference, another company, Complete Genomics, announced plans for a $5,000 sequencing service. Although this will initially be available only to academic institutions and industry for research and clinical trials rather than personal use. So unless you work for a university, you're out of luck for at least a few years. But this is proof of concept. The prices will keep falling. Our next story of the evening concerns something that we all have, but pretty much ignore unless we clean windows, or are hardened criminals, or cops, or have five-year-olds. I'm talking about fingerprints. Have you ever wondered why we have fingerprints? And not just humans, but a bunch of other animals have fingerprints as well. Koalas, tree-climbing monkeys. Basically, the purpose of fingerprints was something that scientists simply have been assuming for a very long time. The theory has been that fingerprints increase friction between the skin and whatever we grab onto, that they make it easier to hold onto objects. The idea has been around for over 100 years, but no one has ever directly tested that hypothesis. That is now over, ladies and gentlemen. The brave Dr. Roland Enos from the University of Manchester decided to take up the gauntlet and find out if that long-held assumption is true. Enos published his results of fingerprint friction studies in this July's issue of the Journal of Experimental Biology. Enos was keen to find out whether fingerprints improve our grip, so he recruited University of Manchester undergraduate Peter Warman to test out fingerprint friction with his own fingers. Enos set up a system to pull a piece of acrylic along his student's finger and measured the amount of friction between the two. He designed a system that could produce forces ranging from a moderate touch to a rigid grip that squashed the entire finger pad against the surface. And then he strapped in the volunteer's index finger into his machine to begin measuring the fingerprint's friction. After lots of experiments dragging the acrylic on fingers and thumbs, it was clear that something didn't quite jive with the previous hypothesis they were testing. Instead of the friction between finger and acrylic increasing in proportion to the amount that the acrylic was pushing against the finger, it increased by a smaller fraction than the good Dr. Enos had expected. So it turns out that fingers do not behave like a normal solid. The skin of the fingers was behaving more like rubber, where the friction is actually proportional to the amount of contact between the two surfaces. That is, the more skin in contact with the surface, the greater the friction. Enos varied the area of each finger pad that came into contact with the surface by dragging narrow and wide strips of acrylic along the finger pads. He found that the friction did increase as more of the fingerprint came into contact with the surface, so the skin was behaving just like rubber. So what's the conclusion? It is, ta-da, fingerprints definitely do not improve a grip's friction because they reduce our skin's contact with objects in our grasp and even seem to loosen our grip in some circumstances. So what the heck do fingerprints do then? Is there any advantage to having them if they don't improve grip? Enos has suggested a couple of alternatives that may still make fingerprints important. It may be that fingerprints are more designed to help grip rough surfaces, like tree bark, not smooth surfaces. Certainly our ancient ancestors would have spent a great deal doing exactly that. Another alternative he suggests is that fingerprints are there to help drain trapped water from our finger pads and improve surface contact under wet conditions. Other researchers have suggested that the ridges have nothing to do with grip at all and are simply there to increase our finger pads' touch sensitivity. Whatever our fingerprints are for, it seems that the idea that they provide friction for grip has gone the way of the dodo. Our last story of the evening is another update on those amazing dolphins. Every time that you think that you've mined out their mind-blowing capacities, something new comes up. This story is from the July issue of the Journal of Experimental Biology. Dr. Lawrence Howell and Paul Weber from Duke University teamed up with Mark Murray from the U.S. Naval Academy and Frank Fish from Westchester University. They got together to find out exactly how it is that dolphins are able to move so fast and easily in the water. Hydrodynamically, what gives them that aquatic agility that we gawk at in the wild or at SeaWorld? The research group made scaled models of flippers for a whole series of dolphin species using computer tomography scanning of their fins. They examined seven different species ranging from the slow Amazon River dolphin to the super-fast striped dolphin. And what did they find? Well, comparing the lift and drag coefficients for each flipper at different inclination angles, they found that the flippers behaved just like modern engineered aerofoils. In short, the fluid flows around the flippers, and the swept back flippers generate lift, like modern delta wing aircraft. The best known example of delta wing planes are the stealth fighter bombers that are admired by so many for their 22nd century designs. There's a direct correlation between the speed of the dolphin species and the quality slash efficiency of their aerofoil flippers. For example, the fast bottlenose dolphin's triangular flippers are the most efficient, while the slower harbor porpoise and the Atlantic white-sided dolphin's fins are the least efficient. The authors speculate how evolution could have come up with that design independently, but they never really get anywhere with it. They suggest that the best way to understand how evolution could have reached this pinnacle of aquatic and hydrodynamic engineering is to find out more about the link between the flippers' performances and the environment that the cetaceans negotiate on a daily basis. In essence, this would tell us the conditions that dolphins evolved in that had the most immediate effects on their developmental selection. Well, that's all from me. Thanks for listening for the last year. As always, take care. And I hope I have inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.